Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'll just wait a second. And welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Adam Francisco, and Scott Keith. We are part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. We now have 10 shows on that network for people to listen to and digest. Some of those are now seasonal shows like Family Style Theology, so you can go check that out. We also have weekly shows like The Thinking Fellows, Virtue in the Wasteland, 40 Minutes in the Old Testament, 30 Minutes in the New Testament, Let the Bird Fly, Banned Books, a whole list of shows covering just a really wide range of topics at this point. It's hard to imagine, but we're doing about 10 hours of content a week just in audio form at 1517, which is fantastic. We've had about 80,000 downloads a month, which is really cool to see. So thank you for being part of that. If you're listening to this episode, if you've been impacted by those shows, could you please consider giving to us? We need financial help to make sure that these podcasts continue to run. So you can go to 1517.org and there's a donate button there. We would really appreciate your help doing that, especially if these have been a part of your weekly routine and you've really benefited from them. It's great to have sort of partners in this endeavor to continue to proclaim the gospel through these various shows. Okay, so we were sitting around here after recording the last episode, sort of thinking of topics to do. We have some plan for the future, and this is always my fault when these kind of situations happen because of not thinking ahead enough and not emailing people diligently.
Too busy jet-setting across the planet.
That's right. And so I kind of get caught up in things, but I realized we have not done an episode covering any sort of apologetic material in a long time. The closest thing that we got to it was during the summer. I went to the Apologetics Academy with a couple other people who are involved at 1517. And we did a short episode briefly talking about our experience there, why people would consider doing something like that, some of the reading ideas we got from there. And I also asked those students who traveled with me, after visiting, they thought some of the apologetic problems that they could be able to address in their life back home because people came from different perspectives. So you can go check that episode out there. But today I thought we'd actually answer some questions related to apologetics. We had one listener question come in last month about Lutheran apologetics, so I thought we would throw that towards Adam since that's somewhere where he has some expertise.
It's a very, very narrow slice.
Yes, that's right. So, and then we'll move on from there perhaps to some relevant apologetic questions. Dr. Keith brought up postmodernism, and he did an episode with Pastor Bruce Hillman on postmodernism as well, which also poses some unique apologetic challenges today. And so we can probably also reflect on, in the face of postmodernism, what some of the strategy to get back to Christ really is.
Yeah, that was in doing that interview with Bruce, that was one of my biggest, I'll say question, but one of the things that sent me thinking after that interview is that how, because he really focused on, I think he was focusing on especially Derrida, Adam and Rod, and I think he very much focused on the desire within postmodernism, you know, not necessarily to be relativistic, but to destroy categories of power and authority, right? And it's interesting because one of the things that I'm trained to do apologetically is to set up Christ as a believable authority, in fact, the most believable authority as God, by laying out the proofs for how he showed that he was God, right? Fulfilled prophecy.
Miracle.
The historical accounts of his miracles, the historical account of his resurrection from the dead, that type of thing. But all that is sort of set up to say, well, then he's God / ultimate authority. So what he said can be believed.
It's very close to the apostolic preaching in the New Testament.
Completely agree. But I think what I'm getting at is if postmodernism is set up for sort of the destruction of categories of power and categories of authority and ultimate narratives.
Yeah, and you're appealing to Christ as authority and ultimate narrative.
It makes it difficult.
Yeah, the other thing we have to remember is that, you know, no apologetic is forever. The culture does change.
Sure.
But what you referred to is the basic in the New Testament. As long as we can stay close to that, the culture will change again and again and again and again. If we don't have a distinctive overcoming of postmodernism, it could be in 10 years, it won't matter because it'll be in the archives of libraries, never to be looked at again. The thing I like about the historical defense of Christianity is it is so close to the New Testament text itself. And I think that's worth remembering when the ones who historically have gotten most caught up in adjusting the faith to what's going on in your particular day are the liberals. Mm. And they've lost everything.
Yeah.
Don't worry about adjusting it infinitely to your week.
I was more wondering like a starting point. Like and I totally agree with you, and that's what I do. That's what I argue for in that class that I
sure.
that lecture that
you,
I do.
You start with those questions with those students.
Right. But it's just interesting that this is what I told Bruce on the interview. I said, we have a whole generation of young people who probably wouldn't even recognize the philosophy of postmodernism as you just laid it out, but who have been raised to accept the categories.
Yep.
And that seems like a problem, right? That seems like a difficult thing to overcome. And I agree. There's no way to change this apologetic to make it... what you're doing is you're going after the historicity of the accounts, and you're showing that
sure.
Christ claimed to be God and that he proved those claims and
sure.
on and on and on. I don't think that, you know, you can make that better or change it to make it more relative or anything like that. I'm more interested in like a conversational starting point with someone who has been taught or has sort of accepted without just even being taught, without just by means of cultural inculcation, that these categories don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Probably that fellow who's the best of evangelicalism who did tactics.
Greg Kokel?
Greg Kokel. Socratic questions. I see. And you base that on what? Or you discovered that how?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've found interestingly like, that one of the universals that even the postmodernists can't shake, even though the particular instances of this might change with them, is sort of starting with the problem of sin, but not like, you know, starting in Genesis, obviously, but going to, obviously they see sort of the abuse of power as a sinful issue, right? Like as a moral issue. And so they, even though some postmodernism is trying to sort of tear down all moral standard and things like that, they still have moral dilemma. And I find that's an entry point to conversation with them, because if we're just kind of reframing ourselves and not trying to just get back to particular instances of sin, but the totality of the effect of sin on the world, I can open that conversation up. I think where Christians tend to stray then is they want to move from that into, well, now homosexuality is a sin and you sleeping with your boyfriend and like, and instead of dealing with that broader issue and then also sort of like Christ giving up power in order to deal with that issue.
Yeah, it's interesting because again, I'm going to bring up his name again, but this Jordan Peterson, who's very popular right now, I mean, he's got millions and millions of followers, and his message isn't the message of the gospel at all.
Yep.
It's full law. It's yep. full about sin, you know.
Yep.
I mean, one of his famous lines is, yeah, you're right, things are bad. They're probably worse than you think, and you're partly to blame, you know. And millions of people hear this, and they acknowledge it. Yeah, you're right. It's worse than I think, and I'm at fault. You might be right. That's a good starting point.
And the other thing is, with anybody who's had even a modicum of a fill to go into, and your particular intense moral stance on X is based on what?
Mm-hmm.
Those who are not Christians are almost forced to have both feet firmly planted in midair.
Mm. Yeah.
And just operate with it and never get called.
Yeah, that's part of what bothers me too. So, and also in our modern climate, you know, a culture that destroyed the idea of right and wrong,
yeah.
claiming ultimate right and wrong on the things which they've decided are right and wrong. And then not only are those things right or wrong, but they're to a higher power,
yep,
right and wrong. I mean, those who are participating in the wrong are in need of utter destruction. No grace, no forgiveness, no possibility therein. And this all brought about by a culture who hasn't dealt with even the category of right and wrong for 40 years.
Right. Right.
It seems like a
there
problem.
Are only a finite number of choices for somebody who's been introduced, even intro to Phil, the lightest, slightest intro to one chapter in an intro to Phil book. The options are very few.
Yeah, I don't know.
You're gonna go with John Stuart Mill, or you're gonna go with Kant. Postmodernism is a thing of its own, but historically, choices there weren't a whole lot. You were gonna be deontological in your ethics, mm-hmm, or you were gonna be with Mill on the greatest good for the greatest number.
I find that still. I think you're absolutely right. Like, if you keep digging, right, keep asking questions, they're not going to recognize Kant and Mill, but they do default to those.
Yep.
Sort of.
I think Paul at Mars Hill, speaking about starting points and things like that, that's a pretty paradigmatic apologia where Paul is looking for whatever sort of, even if it's just terminological common ground he can get.
Yep.
And from there, as sort of a starting point, gets as quickly as possible to, at Mars Hill, he starts with kind of a bit of natural theology, but at the end of that, and we only have 10 verses of what he spoke there. Probably he spoke for a lot longer.
Quotes their own poets.
And they make their way into Holy Scripture, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. Pagan philosophers quoted in Holy Scripture, but mm-hmm, he does all this natural theology, if you will, but towards the end, he says something. I think it's Acts 17:31. He goes, and God has furnished proof of all of this by raising him from the dead.
Yep.
You see it in Paul before Agrippa in Acts 26, where his whole apologetic is finding the starting point and getting to Christ as fulfilled prophecy, or the man who fulfilled messianic prophecies from the Old Testament, or proof of his divinity from his resurrection. And that's kind of, mm-hmm, the circumstances are always going to change. There is in every circumstance something you can grab onto, but you don't want to spend hours arguing about something like, is homosexuality natural or not? So on and so forth. Those are interesting debates and save it. They're useful or maybe in the realm of ethics and so on. You could talk about those. But when it's an apologetic encounter, it's not about that. It's about getting to Christ, him crucified, and more importantly, in an apologetic arena and just preaching arena, him risen from the dead.
Well, and I think in modern Christianity, there are a lot of these kind of branch offs that are really tempting to be really focused on and then call that apologetics.
I can't recommend enough that every parish have the audio of Dr. Montgomery's Sensible Christianity in the church library such that people can play it on discs. Maybe they can't do it like a podcast, but they can put disc in there.
You can buy that online now, and it's honestly really cheap, $24 or something like that, $25. So what Dr. Rosenblatt's talking about is definitely purchasable for a parish, but if you're just interested in it, it's not a huge investment to be able to get these 16 hours.
Yeah, and Dr. Montgomery did those in every little town in Bergen, America for 20 years.
Yeah, and honestly, most people do that on their phone as they drive these days, so buy it for $26, download it, put it on your phone, and play it during your commute.
Sure.
Yeah, you'll get through it, and it helps you. Yeah, it helps you realize what the real issue is. And we've talked about this a lot. The entirety of the idea is to get back to Christ. And I don't want to say this is unique to Lutherans doing apologetics, but I will say, a lot of the other apologetic stuff you're going to get out there is going to get hung up on things like just focusing purely on creation.
Many intro to apologetics books, they will get to Christ and his miracles and his resurrection in chapter 7.
Yeah.
Maybe. That's pretty standard.
Yeah, it's the last thing. I was listening to somebody give an apologetics lecture, and number 7 might have been it. There was these 7 things you needed to identify before you could get to Christ. And basically the idea is you needed to see if they were an atheist first or if they believed in another religion, and the idea was if they're an atheist, get them to deism by arguing yada, yada, yada. If they're not, argue their religion away and then get to...
And then they get hit by a bus the next day and die atheist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dr. Rosenblatt mentioned the book Tactics before, and that, you know, I think there's even an article online that Greg Kokel wrote that sort of summarizes it, but it's really good because it's not about diagnosing what worldview they have, but it gives you kind of a couple questions where you can get to their basic, if you will, their epistemology.
Mm-hmm.
And once you find out how they think about how they know or what they know, then you kind of know which direction to go.
But again, what you guys mentioned earlier, you can discern what the earliest Christians did in various audiences, Paul on Mars Hill, and to Jews, that he was the fulfillment of what the Old Testament said the Messiah was going to be. Anytime you can stay close to that, it's best. Otherwise, there are 1,000 rabbit holes to go down.
Yeah, that's funny. That's what I try to do in that that lecture I do on epistemology, is just that. This is say, encourage people to ask questions that make people think about why they believe the things that they do.
Sure.
You know, and even in the questioning, most people come to the understanding that they do believe certain things based on authority. And then it's a matter of getting them to examine what those authorities are, why they trust that authority over this authority. And most of them, even when they do it at the university, most of them have never even considered, you know, why they believe this is wrong or that is wrong or this is right or that is right or you should do this and not that.
And we belong to a church where the overwhelming majority of the clergy majored in the humanities. They did not, during their college years, major in what I did, in the hard sciences. And it shows up later on that all of their work was in the humanities.
I was going to mention there's a local pastor and evangelist named Mark Jasa, who says that, going back to the issue of authority, Scott, who says that the overwhelming majority of people he encounters on the college campus, for them, the authority is themselves.
Yeah.
So you can give them some pretty solid responses to the objections they might have to Christianity, but even if you, he'll ask the question, what if for the sake of argument, I could demonstrate beyond a reasonable doubt that Jesus rose from the dead, would that change anything?
And their answer is no.
More than 75% say no, because I don't believe in it. So it's not, I mean, even the epistemological starting point in our day and age, it's probably been this way for some time, maybe for thousands of years, I don't know. People believe what they want to believe.
See, it's not even,
evidence doesn't really, evidence doesn't always
do the trick.
Well, I think,
but this isn't about the trick. It's not about the winning the argument or anything like that. It's about giving a, showing that the, that Jesus' death and resurrection, the gospel is not a cleverly devised myth. And in my mind, that's sort of like the apologetic task, not changing. I mean, you can't change somebody's mind on these sorts of things. You can give them a good case, but if they're going to have a change of, well, I should say change of heart, that's going to be something that's outside of our
ability.
The ability of the apologist.
Yeah. It demonstrates the need to, while doing this apologetic task, to keep proclaiming the gospel, that the Spirit is the one who really brings faith in these instances.
In that episode, in that series, Sensible Christianity, Dr. Montgomery addresses the question of the place of apologetics, and he says, and I'm not going to quote him directly because I'm probably not get it right. He says, "Gospel first, evangelism first, apologetics second."
Yeah, so, the apologetics is a branch of evangelism.
Yep,
and the evangelism first, and I'd say evangelism first in the middle and at the end, right? And apologetics when
needed.
As needed throughout.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes we and Dr. Montgomery get, called out for trying to
everything into apologetics.
That's right, or educate people into the faith or something like
that. Or that we are out of line with our own history, that somehow we believe that somebody can be reasoned into trust in Christ. And nothing could be further from the truth. The apologetic task is for somebody to begin to say to themselves, you know, I think this could be true. This might be true. And that's as far as we can go.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Craig Parton was talking about in Strasbourg about a conversation he had with somebody who was convinced, yeah, Christ rose from the dead. But that doesn't, I don't believe.
Couldn't connect the dots.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like, it's reasonable. That's what the history points to. But I don't think he's the savior of the world.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting, right?
Sure. And it sort of asks the question, what would it take for you to be convinced of something miraculous? Maybe nothing. Mm-hmm. Maybe the way you've set it up is that you're utterly safe. Safe from facts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The thing is, it's not our job to predetermine that about somebody, right? We're not called to sort of figure that out and give
Well, the
up.
Best is if they tell you.
Yeah.
That's conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First Peter 3:15 says it, always be prepared to give a reason for those who ask for the hope within you. Uh-huh. So it's always a response to whatever somebody's objecting to or what they're accusing you of. And it's not about winning a formal debate. Or, I mean, those things might be helpful, but it's more of a practical discipline.
Well, I think there are hundreds of people who, quote, grew up in the church and never heard anything addressed to their minds other than unbelief.
Yeah, I think part of the apologetic task today is preparing people for questions that are going to be tossed, their way, challenges to their faith. You know, a lot of pastors who were at the Apologetics Academy were talking about that this is partially because of the high schoolers they know who are going on to college. And so it's not necessarily making a case, but helping them to have a reasonable defense for the hope that is within them.
Sure.
I'd like for them, when they go on from high school to college, you know, I don't always want to task, and I guess maybe I should, because the scriptures do task them with giving a positive defense publicly, but I'd like them to have some tools in the toolbox so that when their faith is being challenged, you know, publicly, and they're internalizing this privately, that they have something there that they can at least work through in their head that says, well, you know, yeah, what he says, he or she says up there makes sense, but this also makes sense, you know, or this makes more sense, and here's why, and being able to reason that through. The biggest danger that we sort of thrust upon our kids is sending them out without any tools in the toolbox.
Yes.
Mentally, I mean, I could go on otherwise too, to sort of engage a world that's real and that's not designed to just protect them.
Right.
We're going to take a short break right here and then we'll be right back. We're going to finish up this discussion and maybe have time for that Luther question as well. Hello there, and welcome to our break. Today I'm going to talk about a newer book at the 1517 Publishing House. We have, it's called Always Be Ready. It's actually a new entry from Dr. Montgomery. It's a primer or an introduction into apologetics. It's
for children. Is it?
I think one of the target audiences was that it should be digestible by middle school, be able to be digested by middle schoolers.
Got it.
So the reading level is not high, but I would not say it is written as a children's book.
Okay.
Having read it myself. So I would say this is still, you're not going to feel like you're reading a book, you know, significantly below you if you're an educated lay person. So what it does do is it makes this whole conversation very simple and compact, and it's smaller than History Long Christianity, for instance. And so I would call it like weekend reading. You could pick it up, finish it on a Saturday if you know you set a little bit of time apart. And I think the most helpful thing about this book is it just starts you getting thinking on what some of the questions might be. Where History, Law, and Christianity are going to actually present sort of the positive argument in a very thorough and researched way, and then those get broken into other bigger books within Dr. Montgomery's writings. This one is getting you started on basic questions, basic answers, sort of so that you know what is out there, right? I feel like there are people who haven't been hit with these actual questions or challenges to their faith before, and then it happens, and they've never thought about it, and it can be really rattling. Something like always be ready is the idea is to be ready for some of these attacks and for some of the questions that you might get when you're evangelizing and the like. And so it's, I don't think it's really tasking you, so now you have to go out and do this, but it is preparing you to
Good.
Know what's on the horizon. So you can buy that on the 1517 website. So you go to shop.1517.org, and it's on our website, and it's available for sale. I believe it's $10. And if you are a first-time shopper in our store, you can get 10% off, so that makes it pretty cheap. If you get a couple of them, maybe to give away, maybe to give to, like Dr. Rosenblatt said, a child in your home, also to read, you can get free shipping or reduced shipping on that, depending on how much. So I think free shipping happens like over $25 on our website or something like that. So you can get a couple copies, give them away to people at church, give them away to people in Bible study and things like that. I think it's a great resource. I've been leaning more and more towards things. When I was in Norway too, I was giving the pamphlet Medium and Length away with other book sales because it's something that people can hand to people, just like the Christ Alone booklet that you've done too. And so anything that it isn't hugely financially taxing and is also like reasonably expected that somebody could read it because it's short and the language is, you know, not over everybody's head, I think is a fantastic resource. I mean, one of the best things is being able to give somebody a book. So check that out. Again, it's shop.1517legacy.com, and the name of the book is Always Be Ready. Okay, so we're going to hit the back end of this episode. Is there anything we wanted to wrap out about sort of, I would like to call that beginning section like the apologetic task today. We're really seeing that postmodernism and sort of these hidden philosophies are as big of a problem, if not bigger, than sort of the reasonably argued atheist or scientist. So,
at least different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely something you're going to encounter, whether you're a listener and it's with your own kids, with your grandchildren, with students in your congregation and things like that. This is definitely a part of the culture, a part of the philosophy, whether they know it or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the schools will very early on set them against anything objective. Mm. They won't admit it, but that's really what's going on. They're going to strengthen the self and the autonomy of the self in a child. I think that guy from Colorado, that lawyer, could sue the NEA for child abuse and win it. The murder of the mind.
Mm. Yeah. It really is interesting. You're definitely going to have to, I mean, parents are always supposed to be involved, but you have to take more of the education into your own hands. Even if they are still going to public school, there's definitely things you're going to have to do at home, like
the
idea that there are facts is apparently one of those things now. Yeah. So
it's almost like you have to, as a parent, do the job of who are those guys who used to, in the 70s, take kids who are in cult, deprogrammers. You have to deprogram the kid from what they learned in the factory schools. Sorry, that's a little negative.
Well, I've said to
Adam, how do you really feel?
I've said to other parents, I wish that they could get permission from the ed authorities to school their kids at home using Khan Academy or others, where there's a genuine curriculum, because there isn't one left in the schools.
Yep. Oh, well, on that note, no, just kidding. And if there are school teachers listening, I do feel for you as well, because some of those...
They have no choice.
That's right. Some of those limitations fall on teachers whose hands are tied and do the best they can with the situation they're in. So, Adam, we have a question that I think particularly pertains to you, and that is, this listener said he heard us mention that Luther engaged in some sort of apologetic behavior before, but wants to know where and why. I think it's a reasonable question, because if you think about kind of the world at the time, the biggest problem wasn't that there weren't Christians, right? It's that sort of everybody, quote unquote, was Christian in that world. And so what does apologetics in Luther's time look like or function as?
Well, I mean, there were non-Christians in Europe. There were Jewish populations, and Luther wrote quite a few things addressing Jewish theological objections to the gospel. Very early on in 1523, he wrote a work called That Christ Was Born a Jew, That is, most of his activity with respect to Judaism is showing that, just like Paul did when he went to the synagogues, as was his custom, as Luke wrote, showing that Jesus' death and resurrection linked up to or fulfilled messianic prophecy. That is, it was necessary for the Messiah from the pages of the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament to suffer and to die, and that Jesus was the person who fulfilled all that. Mm-hmm. Now, there's another in the later Middle Ages, in Luther's day and age, especially in Luther's day and age, 1529, there's another non-Christian threat that is starting to penetrate Europe. In 1529, the Ottoman Turks are at the gates of Vienna, and there are little Muslim enclaves starting to take shape in Hungary. And so Luther has to address mostly as sort of like the teacher or the personality that everybody looks to for advice. He has to address the challenge that Islam posed to Christianity, because he had heard all sorts of reports. Some probably were hyperbolic, but some we know from historical research were actually true, that there are Christians in Eastern and Central Europe who are embracing Christianity, not necessarily just by force, but are actually just simply embracing it as a replacement to Christianity. And so Luther writes a number of works addressing the issue of the Turks that cover a whole bunch of issues. But in all of those works, there's some apologetic element to it. His last work is a translation of an old but also very famous medieval Christian apologetic directed at Islam. He called it a refutation of the Quran. And in there, Luther approaches apologetics negatively. That is, he tears down, or if you will, to use Dr. Keith's postmodern language, deconstructs Islam. And then in the aftermath, after he's deconstructed, he makes a positive case for Christianity. And interestingly, Luther, so it's a translation from this Dominican monk, but Luther adds in a whole bunch of stuff to the text, takes out a lot of references to Aristotle, adds in his own coarse language, and makes the...
Luther added coarse language?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
It's fantastic. But he also adds in some odd stuff, like, for example, that when Muhammad wrote the Quran, Muhammad didn't write the Quran, but Luther thought he did, the Holy Spirit caused Muhammad to write things into the Quran that could be used for Christians, or used by Christians later on. So, for example, Quran chapter 4, verse 171 refers to Jesus as the Kalimatullah, or the Word of Allah, the Word of God. And also it mentions a Ruhala, a Spirit of God. And Luther says, see, Muhammad unwittingly confessed the doctrine of the Trinity here. And now, Luther is not using the Quran as if it's inspired. He's using it as a base from which defense of Christianity could be made. Mm-hmm. Now,
God can work evil for good.
Yeah, it's really hard to do that from the Quran, and Muslims certainly have canned responses to it. But that Luther was willing to be that creative in addressing Islam, which, according to Melanchthon, was the hereditary enemy of Christendom in the 16th century, is pretty interesting. Now, those are the historic, or those are the things that Luther does in terms of apologetics. Another question that might be asked along these lines is Luther, or is Lutheran theology, open to the apologetic task? And here we'd have to defer to Dr. Montgomery.
Well, those Mankato lectures he gave to Lutherans on Luther and apologetics, those are available still.
Yeah. I think if you type in Google the apologetic thrust of Lutheran theology, it'll be one of the first selections.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting is, even in the face of sort of the error within the church, his go-to is to drive back to the cross of Christ, the forgiveness of sins that happens in the death and resurrection of Christ. If you look at his theology, that's a constant theme, right? Is going back to there. When we're talking about the apologetic task, that is constantly what we're trying to seek to do, is to bring people back to that event. And so there's some similarity there.
Yeah, and it's good counsel. I learned it from him over decades, but it's really good counsel not to get lost even on important subjects. The key question is the person ready to consider Christ's claims? He or she may not be, but a factual presentation of the gospel is in line with the New Testament text.
All right.
I think that's a great wrap up to this episode. Thank you for the listener who asked that question so that we could fill that second half. And if you have apologetic questions, you can go ahead and send them our way. That's definitely one of the categories where we're able to dive in and email you back or do it on another episode. We hope you enjoyed this episode, that you found it helpful. If you are a listener of this show and are looking to support, you can go to 1517.org and there's a donate button up there. And then you can sort of join us in this effort to keep this kind of content online where we're focusing on the proclamation of Christ through apologetics, history, and church doctrine. All right. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.